Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show, and thank you again for listening. It always makes me very happy when I hear from people. You know, a friend of mine or somebody I know at work told me about the Patrick Madrid Show. So if you've done that, thank you. And if you haven't done that, maybe give that some thought. Maybe you can let some people that you know about the program. I'm going to get into a lot of emails today. I've got a lot to talk about, including a few things that are, you know, in the news right now I want to share with you. But I also have made many promises about trying to read your emails when they come in. And as a result, I've got a huge stack of emails. So chances are probably no phone calls this hour, maybe even for the rest of the show. We'll see. But let's dive in straight away to the first of the big stack of emails that I have here. This one comes in from Jasmine. She says, "Hi, Patrick, I have a major question to ask you. I have a problem that I gossip too much and I don't have self-control. I know it's a major sin and I don't know how to stop it. How do I stop it? Please let me know. I know we're all sinners, but I talk too much." Talk about some beautiful honesty there. She says, "I talk too much. I got fired at my first job. But that's because I had to work with people who gossip and talked bad about me. I'm too innocent and I talk too much. How do I stop this program? How do I stop this problem?" Excuse me. We don't want to stop the program. We want the program to continue. Well, Jasmine, I have some advice, some of it from my own personal experience, some of it from the Holy Bible. And of course, that's much more important. Why don't we start with that? It says in James chapter 4, "Do not speak evil against one another, brothers. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge." Now, this is one of many examples in Scripture where it warns against gossip, and there are different words that are used for it. Gossip, of course, is where you are telling tales, whether they're true or not. You're talking about somebody. There are some situations where it's necessary to talk about somebody. You're a husband and a wife, and you're talking about a situation involving one of your kids. They're in trouble at school, or they did something wrong. That's not gossip. If you are in a business setting, and the CEO calls you into his office and says, "You know, I need your advice. We've got a problem in the company, and so just did this, and that resulted in that, and I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to go about doing this, so I'm taking the advice of some people that I think are wise, and you're one of them, so let's talk about it. Maybe you can give some advice." That's not gossip. If there's something going on in the news, and somebody has made a fool of himself, or there's some, you know, scandal or something like that, that could be gossip if there's no reason to be discussing it. But if it's something in the news and it's publicly known and you happen to be talking about it with a coworker, that's not gossip. Rather, gossip is where you are, as I said a minute ago, telling tales, whether they're true or not, and just discussing details about another person. Usually, almost always, when somebody gossips, it's derogatory. It's negative. It can be very often spiteful. It can be a way to try to harm somebody's reputation. And there are variations on a theme, of course. Detraction, slander, calumny, these are all species of gossip where you, in a variety of different ways, may seek to harm another person's reputation by saying things. In the case of somebody who is innocent of what you're saying they did and they really didn't do it, it's all the more injurious. It can also take the form of telling somebody's maybe some secret things about the person that people don't know and don't have a right to know, and you have no reason. You're not in law enforcement. You're not a judge. You're not somebody who has a reason to know or to talk about this situation, and you freely volunteer something personal about somebody else that other people don't know, very injurious. I'm aware, to give you an example, I'm aware of a situation, Jasmine, and I became aware of this years ago, where there was a, and I have to be delicate about how I phrase this just to make sure that innocent people are protected, but there was a situation in a church kind of setting. It wasn't a parish setting. It was a kind of a church type of setting in which the knowledge of one person's involvement in abortion was not publicly known. And somebody in this churchy situation who had reason to become aware of it blabbed it to other people who had no reason to know about it. Something as private and sensitive as that is not something that other people have a right to know about. Now, if that person wanted to make them aware of it, that's a different story. But that person did not seek to make anybody aware of it. But the person who knew about it and had no business speaking about it publicly did so. That is a very destructive and evil, malicious form of gossip. Now, I'm only saying these things, Jasmine, to kind of give you a sense of you'll have to be the one to decide where you fit in this bigger picture of gossip and related sins of slander and calumny and detraction, etc. So what do you do about it? How do you handle that? What do you say? How can I stop it? Well, the simple answer is, and this is true for any sin, is in the case of gossip, just close your mouth. Now, I'm not saying that to be flippant or disrespectful, but like the old saying goes, bite your tongue. Why do we bite our tongues? Because we're so intent upon the pain that it causes us when you bite your tongue that you don't say anything. So that would be a simple thing to remember. Just zip it. Your mouth will get you into trouble if you let it, and all of us are capable of that happening. So that would be my advice to myself. Zip it. If you're tempted to say something negative, derogatory, spiteful, sharing information about somebody's personal life that other people don't have a right to know, or even if they have a right to know, maybe it's out in the public, there's no need to be wallowing in the mud hole of gossip about somebody else's life. I mean, one of the things that's easy to do if you want a thought experiment is just try to imagine how you would feel if somebody was doing that about you. And it becomes very simple at that point. As Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And like you, I don't like it when people say negative things about me. And being human like you, all of us are this way. It's injurious. It hurts when other people are gossiping. So that would be, I think the simplest answer would be just zip it. Just close your mouth. Don't say anything. I know that's easier said than done. But if you really want to take the very first step when it comes to not gossiping, I would start there. Now, let me share with you, as I mentioned, there's some biblical teaching on this issue. In James chapter 3, it talks about the mouth, the tongue, and the danger that it can cause. Verse 2, for we all make many mistakes, and if anyone makes no mistakes in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body also. If we put bits into the mouths of horses that they may obey us, we guide their whole bodies. Now, those of you who are equestrians, you know what this is talking about. It's that little piece of metal that fits in the mouth of the horse, and it's attached to the harness that goes around the head, which eventually comes to you in the reins, and just a little tug one way or the other, that bit in the mouth of the horse can turn, as it says here in James 3, can turn the whole body of the horse. Just by that little bit, you get the pun there, right? Verse 4, look at the ships also. Though they are so great and are driven by strong winds, yet they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So, he says, the tongue is a little member, and he's referring to a member like your bodily members. The tongue is a little member and boasts of great things. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire. And the tongue is a fire. The tongue is an unrighteous world among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the cycle of nature, and set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature can be tamed, and has been tamed by humankind, but no human being can tame the tongue, a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brethren, this ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening fresh water and brackish? Can a fig tree, my brethren, yield olives or a grapevine figs? No more can salt water yield fresh. So the point here is to govern your tongue, govern your speech. And I say this to myself as much as to anyone else, since you asked for my advice on this, Jasmine, you know, and we're sort of thinking about this out loud. But that is the way to do this. Now, one final thing, and this is basically drawn from the testimony of the saints, the lives of the great saints, those who practiced virtue. And that is, it's another very simple thing, easier said than done, but it can be done. And that is the way to eradicate a vice, and in this case, the vice is gossip. The way to eradicate a vice is to cultivate the opposing virtue. So you would say, well, what is the opposing virtue? If I'm gossiping about other people, and maybe it also takes the form of slander, or it takes the form of, you know, taking somebody's reputation out and beating it to death with evidence or information that's true or not true. Well, the way to avoid that sin and to destroy it eventually is to cultivate the virtue of being prudent, of not saying anything. So it's a form of temperance in speech. We have to be temperate when it comes to food and drink and sleep and such, but we can also be temperate in drink. And this is one reason, I think, in the wisdom of the great saints, especially those who started religious orders, and that is that in religious orders that observe a more strict rule, you'll notice that there are large sections of time where they're silent. And maybe they eat their meals in silence as opposed to conversing over the dinner table. Rather, they eat their meals in silence. It's a form of mortification, but its purpose is to help build up that tendency to avoid idle chitter-chatter, to avoid frivolity. And usually, very often anyway, that's where the vice of gossip comes in. So just remember that phrase, zip it, number one. If you're tempted to say something, stop and think, is this something, the kind of thing that I would want somebody to say about me? Remember how powerful and destructive the tongue can be, as it says in James chapter 3. And that one line there I find very striking, where it talks about how a great forest can be set ablaze by a small fire. And isn't it true that even a careless whisper can result in terrible damage done to people's careers? So those are my thoughts, Jasmine. I hope that that's helpful to you. Thank you. Here is an email that comes in from Martha. She says, it's always great listening to your program. She says, I was listening to an earlier discussion about the effects of Vatican II. It's so interesting to me, she says, the parallels between our current situation and the world and how changes in the church are made starting in the 1960s and 70s. As you explained, proponents of progressive ideas, mostly German and Austrian priests and bishops, reference the Holy Spirit, or just the Spirit, to justify some pretty awful liturgical changes. Maybe it was hard to argue with, as it perhaps sounded authoritative, but still it's vague, she says, and people should have pushed back for more rational specifics. Similarly, today, around the world, violations of various freedoms have been made in the name of protection from an invisible virus that we've been told to be terrified of. Not that I am, she says. Before we went along with lockdowns and masks, we should have demanded more rational explanations as to why these were necessary. I've heard the expression, as goes the church, so goes the world. It seems to me the nuttiness, that's her word, the nuttiness in the church preceded the nuttiness in the world by about 50 years, or was it just a matter of time? Of course, she says, the gates of hell will not prevail. God is 100% in control, so we are grateful for our faith. And she says, I am grateful for your show. God bless you, Martha. Martha, thank you. Well, there's a lot there to talk about. And I'm not so sure that it's necessarily one before the other, that the upheaval in the Catholic Church that took place in the 1960s in the form of the Second Vatican Council, I'm not so sure that that was prior to certain upheavals in the world. You mentioned COVID sort of you mentioned it tangentially. Seems to me that the way in which there was such friction and division, and it continues to this day over issues like vaccinations and such, I think that's indicative, if you ask me, it's kind of symptomatic of a great deal of angst and distrust that exists in this country, a lot of it driven by politics, and much of it extending back for, let's say, at least back to the 1960s. So if you want a kind of historical perspective, consider the fact that prior to the Second Vatican Council, which took place in the early 60s into the mid 60s, there was a lot of upheaval going on in the world, a lot of upheaval, a lot of radical changes that were underway. And we saw a destabilization after the Second World War, when things seemed to be sort of getting back on track again. There was a destabilization in society with the rise of the anti-war movement during the time of Vietnam. And the anti-war movement was destabilizing because it separated, it caused a great deal of division among Americans as to whether or not we should be fighting over there in the first place. Now, that war was a long time in the making. In fact, President Eisenhower in the 1950s, he actually did a great deal to prevent us from going to Vietnam much earlier. He avoided it, much to his credit. I don't think he gets that much credit because people don't know the history behind it, but the war in Vietnam was brewing for a long time. Eventually, when we wound up getting caught up in it, it was a real hot-button issue politically as well as socially. That was one thing. We had the assassinations of major figures in the United States and elsewhere too, but in the United States. So President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, and then in 1968, the double assassinations of Martin Luther King as well as Robert Kennedy that summer. And there were many other assassinations which were deeply traumatic to people. We had the rise of mass media in a way that we had never seen it before. I remember as a child in the 1960s, there were maybe half a dozen television stations that one could look at, and now there are thousands of them. And we've experienced a kind of division or fragmentation in the form of how many different options we have for simple information. And people who get their information from a variety of sources are likely to have a less similar way of looking at the world. A lot of other antagonisms. We've had the race riots, the Jim Crow laws that were finally, thankfully, written out of existence, the civil rights movement and all the upheaval that went with that. And I thank God that we had the civil rights movement and that we still do, and that there are efforts continuously underway to eradicate racism. But that was a tremendous upheaval in the United States. And it, again, it was a necessary step. It must have been taken, but it invariably caused a great deal of friction and division. And sometimes those things are unavoidable. But the reason I'm going through this little history overview is to say that with the rise of the mass media, the rise of freely available contraception, the sexual revolution, the drug revolution, and all the things that were happening in the world and to a certain extent in this country, those things were happening before the council, with a few exceptions. Those were happening before the council. So it just so happens that the Second Vatican Council occurred at the same time or in the immediate aftermath of all these other destabilizing factors in society. And I remember, as best I can, because I was not quite 10 years old. How old was I? I was about maybe 7 years old, I guess, when the council ended. So I only have a dim child's memory of it. But I do remember, especially going into the 70s, how wild and crazy it was in many respects, where people, it was almost like a different religion. And from one Catholic parish to another, there might be a wide swing between something more traditional and what you might have expected to see in a Catholic church in the years leading up to that. In some cases, it was quite the opposite, where everybody was overrun with felt banners. And there were so many changes that were so different and so sudden that it was very disorienting for people. So to get back to the point that you made, Martha, the idea of people justifying by referring to the spirit of the council, when in fact the council did not necessarily envision some of the things that people were suggesting that we do or they were forcing to be done. You're right about that. That all really did happen. But I guess this is what I'm trying to get to here. I don't know whether it's the chicken or the egg here. It's hard to know this close in time to the events, whether or not the church was affected by what was going on in the world, and then that played out and reverberated across the aftermath liturgically and theologically and in many other ways after the Second Vatican Council, or if what we're seeing today, you mentioned COVID, if maybe there's some repercussions from the council. And the last thing I'll say on that issue, because it is an open question that I don't claim to have an answer for, but the last thing I'll say is I do believe that after the council, there were those elements in the Catholic Church, and by that I'm referring to clergy as well as to lay people, who, for whatever reason, are more left of center. They're more, to use the word, progressive, although I don't think progressivism in the modern sense really has to do at all with anything with regard to true progress, but rather a kind of leftist tilt in the direction of iconoclasm, changing things, getting rid of things, undoing things. We don't like the way this has been done for 2,000 years, so we're going to do it differently, kind of mindset in some cases. And I think that that right there has a lot to do with some of the division that we see in the country on an issue like COVID. It's also driven politically and the hardening of the positions. Certainly not the first time in the country's history that this has happened, but in living memory, I think we've seen a much deeper division arise among Americans in, say, the last 20 years or so. I really began to take notice of it during the administration of President Ronald Reagan back in the 80s. It was polarized to the max with President Nixon. Of course, he had to resign. There you have the anti-war movement. So it's not as though it started with Reagan, but the seeds of this, I think, were really beginning to sprout with Ronald Reagan because of the open hostility that much of the media had toward him simply because of his conservatism and also because of his pro-life position, keeping in mind that Roe versus Wade had been decided in 1973, not long before Richard Nixon had to step down. And in Richard Nixon's case, it had nothing to do with abortion. It was all about Watergate and dirty tricks and the Vietnam War, etc. So my sense of it, and I'll leave it at this, is that the divisions in this country that are political in nature have exacerbated the divisions in the country that are, in some cases, religious, as well as our national response to the issue of COVID. Because of the deep misgivings and misunderstandings and mutual suspicions and paranoia and even hatred that some people feel for, quote unquote, the other side, the other party, whichever side you may be on. And that has further led to this sense of a standoff, a stalemate between those who want vaccines versus those who don't want vaccines, those who want to wear masks versus those who don't want to wear masks. A lot of this, I think, is an amalgamation of these religious frustrations and divisions multiplied with the social frustrations as well as the political frustrations. And it's all kind of amalgamated into one single pulsing, throbbing sense of discontent and mistrust of the other side of the country. Now, how's that for a long and winding road of an answer? But I mean, you raise an important question, and it's not, to my mind at least, it's not open to a simple answer. So those are my thoughts, and I hope you find them interesting, if nothing else. Well, I have more emails ahead we're going to get to. We'll take a quick time out, and we'll come right back to the Patrick Madrid Show right here on Relevant Radio.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for listening once again. And today I want to spend a lot of time digging into emails. I don't do that often enough, quite frankly, and they do stack up. So just to be fair to all of you who have taken time out of your busy days to send me an email, I want to do right by you and spend some time really going through a lot of these, as many as we can in any case today. So I think we're going to hold the phone calls for the day so we can get through this. This email comes in from Vicky, who says, I would love to invite my non-practicing daughter to attend Easter Mass with me. In the past, I have, but I told her that she could not receive communion, but she then goes to communion anyway. I don't really want to invite her anymore. Am I doing the right thing here? Thank you, Vicky. Vicky, my heart goes out to you, and I can imagine that, I'm reading between the lines here, but if I'm assuming correctly, that you raised your daughter as Catholic and she's fallen away, it really pains you not only to see her fallen away, but also when she goes to Mass with you, which is great. The fact that she's going to Mass is a good thing. But she doesn't seem to be aware that she shouldn't be receiving communion until she's gone to confession. So although I can understand your sense of frustration and you say that you don't really want to invite her anymore, I would encourage you to try to fight against that tendency to just shut down what, to my mind, looks like it's progress. Now, granted, it's not progress in the strict sense for her to be going to communion if she hasn't received the sacrament of confession first, because after all, if you walk away from the church, you stop practicing your faith, you don't go to Mass on Sunday, even just those things alone are serious sins. But over time, chances are, especially if she's not really interested in her faith or maybe she's not praying anymore, the likelihood of racking up some mortal sins seems to me to be pretty good. So she's objectively not in a situation where she should be receiving Holy Communion. But I do still see progress here. So if she's not practicing the faith and yet she still is willing to go to Mass with you, that's a positive sign. And I would hate to see that squelched, even though I understand your frustration and why you would say, well, I'm just not going to invite her anymore. So what I would do is I would invite her and keep inviting her. And of course, in the background, be praying for her to have a breakthrough. Pray for her to have her eyes opened. Pray for her to have a reconnection with Jesus Christ and thus with her faith. And at the same time, give her some encouragement as to why she should be prepared to receive communion. You could talk about what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. The whole second half of the chapter is a warning about not receiving communion. Well, the whole second half of the chapter is a discussion about the Eucharist itself, as St. Paul said that it was revealed to him by Jesus because he wasn't at the Last Supper. St. Paul wasn't one of the 12 apostles. But it was revealed to him what Jesus did at the Last Supper. And then he says, therefore, somebody should not receive Holy Communion if he is unworthy. Because if he does that, then he's guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord, which is a euphemism, as I often point out, for homicide. If you receive Holy Communion unworthily or in the state of mortal sin, it's a form of murder. St. Paul says, anyway. So he says, don't receive communion if you're unworthy. Now, the way to become worthy, none of us is truly worthy, of course, to receive our Lord and Holy Communion in any strict sense, but in a general sense, you can be prepared and properly disposed to receive communion if you've gone to confession. Make a good sacrament of confession. Now, I know you know this, but it's the kind of thing you could share with your daughter. And this is nice because it actually is the form of an invitation for her to come back home. And you can say, I think it's wonderful that you want to receive Holy Communion, daughter of mine. I think it's great. And I rejoice in the fact that you still see that as something important. And I'd like to help you benefit to the max when you receive Holy Communion. So this is why I just want to share with you what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11 about how you shouldn't receive if you're in the state of unworthiness. And it's easy to get out of that state, and that is to go to confession. And then to resume your faith life. Resume being a follower of Jesus Christ. To resume taking your faith seriously. Meaning that you are willing to accept all these good gifts that the Lord wants you to have in and through his church, rather than to spurn them and say no, to say yes. So even the way you go about presenting this to her could be in the form of an invitation. Now, the second half of the warning says that if you don't recognize or discern the body, then you're eating and drinking judgment on yourself when you receive communion. Another way to translate that would be you're eating and drinking damnation unto yourself. Another very stern warning. And he concludes by saying, this is why many of among you are ill, and some of you are even dying. Whether we don't know precisely whether or not he meant that in a literal sense. Were there people who received Holy Communion in those days who were either unworthy or they didn't believe in the real presence of Christ? They didn't recognize the body, or they didn't recognize the body of the church as a whole. And were they actually getting physically ill and dying? It seems so. But regardless, it certainly is the case that from a spiritual standpoint, those harms are present when somebody receives Holy Communion unworthily, etc. So try that. Try talking to her about that and just inviting her back and just say, you know, I know that you have a nice life, but it could be so much nicer. It could be so much happier, so much more fulfillment if you are listening to Jesus, because after all, he said, come follow me. Jesus didn't say be a Catholic in name only. He didn't say be a Catholic who goes to Mass every so often, maybe. Jesus didn't say be spiritual but not religious. Jesus said, come follow me. And that involves, as he also said, picking up your cross. So yeah, there are some aspects of being a follower of Jesus that are not fun, but Jesus didn't call us to fun. He called us to freedom and happiness. All the fun's going to happen in heaven. You may have a little fun of the nice kind in this life, but eventually, ultimately, that's all waiting for you in heaven. But in the meantime, we have to follow Jesus, and that does involve picking up the cross. And that's why we have the Holy Eucharist in the first place. As Jesus said in John chapter 6, your fathers ate manna in the desert and they died. But I am the bread that comes down from heaven, he said. Whoever eats this bread will never die. And maybe as you share that with your daughter, you could point out that in the wandering of the desert, in the wandering in the desert that the Israelites went through with Moses, they were grumbling and unhappy, and they were tired, and they were worn out, and they were also hungry. They were starving to death in some cases. So what did God do? He worked a miracle, and he created miraculously this stuff that when they came out of their tents in the morning, ready to go through yet another day with no food, and they saw this lying on the ground, it looked kind of like bread. And it was edible, and they said, what is it? Well, that's where the word manna comes from in Hebrew. It means, what is it? That's literally what manna means. What is this? And so Jesus invokes that miracle in his Bread of Life discourse, and he says, your fathers ate manna in the desert, and they died, because that's not going to give you the kind of life eternal that Jesus came to give us. So maybe in sharing with your daughter, you can say, Jesus wants you to live forever. He came to give you life and to give it to you abundantly. And he comes to you in the form of the Holy Eucharist because he wants you to live forever. He wants to strengthen you and prepare you to go to heaven. Now, if you love Jesus and if you believe in Jesus, don't you want that? I mean, wouldn't you want that from Jesus if you do believe in him? And I'll bet you, even if maybe in the moment, Vicky, your daughter doesn't say anything to you, I wouldn't be surprised if you're in your gentle, loving, motherly way, if some of these questions actually result in her thinking about it. And who knows, maybe there will be a breakthrough. It often happens. It truly often happens. Thanks, Vicky. Here's an email that comes in from Anthony. He says, I discovered you one day as I was listening to the radio while driving. I try to catch you because in a chaotic world, I find that your words bring peace and clarity. Thank you for that, Anthony. He says, God has given you a gift for sharing, and I thank you for it. Well, I thank you for that. He says, my wife and I have been married for about 17 years. Her faith journey has been a bit different from mine. She was raised a Catholic in South America, but has been more of an evangelical Protestant since her college days. I'm a cradle Catholic. I still practice my Catholic faith, but my wife has really challenged me on why I remain Catholic. Although I feel I have a pretty strong faith, I realized I really did not know how to respond to her many questions about the Catholic Church. The upside is that it has motivated me to try and learn more about why I believe what I believe and why the Church does certain things. In any case, I'm writing today because I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for Bible studies that my wife and I can work on together. There are so many out there, and I value any input or advice that you have and to direct me to a resource. Well, Anthony, I am so happy to be able to help you with this. There are a number of really good Catholic Bible studies. Father Mike Schmitz has got a Bible study through the year. That's something you can look up online. It's very popular. Dr. Scott Hahn has many Bible studies available. If you go to his website, scotthahn.com, you will find a section on Bible study suggestions and many resources. I particularly like a Bible study that is called Catholic Scripture Study International. And their website, for the longest time, let me just see if it's the same thing here. It was a cssprogram.org. I want to double check that. And okay, so cssprogram.org was the old site, but now I see you can access this Catholic Bible study at St. Benedict Press. So if you just type in St. Benedict Press, there you'll find under the Bible study section, Catholic Scripture Study. And I'm familiar with it, I should say, because I know the people who are involved, and it's really well done. It's got video teaching, so it's not like you have to do all the work. You've got teachers on video who are presenting this to you. It also has the workbook. It's got the Bible with the chain references in it, and it's quite good, very trustworthy and helpful. And then lastly, you might be interested in going through Jeff Cavin's Bible Timeline series. Now, there are a couple different versions. One is called The Great Adventure, which is where you see the big picture chronologically and thematically in Scripture, kind of moving from the Old Testament forward. And then he's got a few other permutations of that that involve more specific focus on particular books of the Bible and other things like that. So any of these, I think, would be good for you. And I really like the idea of you and your wife studying these together. Now, the one other thing I would mention is a book. Now, I edited the book, and I'm not trying to sell you a book, but I do believe that this book would be very helpful to you. And that's called Surprised by Truth. Now, if she was raised in South America, there is a Spanish language version of that, Asombrado por la Verdad. You can pick up a cheap used copy for peanuts online if you want. So, I mean, you don't have to spend a ton of money or anything. But that book has got a lot of, well, by a lot of, I mean 11 testimonies of men and women who, much like your wife, came from an evangelical Protestant background, and each of them became Catholic. So whether it's the Spanish language version, Asombrado por la Verdad, or it's the English language version, Surprised by Truth, I think either one would be good for both of you for this reason. Number one, it will help to answer a lot of questions that she may have. And number two, it will help you to bulk up on your knowledge of the faith. And between the two of you, I think this resource especially will be helpful in bridging that gap. All right. Well, thanks for the email. I'm going to take another break, but we're coming right back. I've got plenty more emails I'm going to read. Maybe yours is one of them. You'll find out on the other side of this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right. We are back again. Thank you for listening to the program. As I mentioned earlier, I am way overdue and spending a lot of time on answering so many of your emails that have come in. And the stack is big and getting bigger. So I don't think we're going to do phone calls today. We're going to focus on these emails. Here's one that comes in from Lorraine. She says, "Hi, Mr. Madrid. My daughter is 17 years old. I'm a cradle Catholic, and I was raised in a household with two Catholic parents and six brothers and sisters. We always went to Mass and prayed together. I've raised my daughter the same way, but with even more benefits than I had. We've traveled to Rome, to Lourdes, to Knock, that's in Ireland, by the way, to the Oratory of St. Joseph, to Our Lady of the Cape. We go to Mass and Adoration. I make sure she prays before she goes to school each day. But, and this is all in caps, but unless I ask her, she will not say the rosary with me. This bothers me very much. I sent her to a Eucharistic camp in Ireland when she was 11 years old. She loves the Mass and she knows the importance of it. She goes to confession, but unless I ask her explicitly, she will not say the rosary with me. To me, the rosary is more than just a private devotion. It's a mini catechism of Christ's life, and it's very important to meditate on him. The daily rosary profoundly changed my life for the better. I just cannot imagine life without Our Lady. She is my very good friend and helper. How can I get my daughter to say the rosary willingly with me? Well, let me start by saying, Lorraine, what a great problem to have. And I don't mean the fact that your daughter won't willingly pray the rosary on her own, but what a wonderful job you've done with your daughter. And how wonderful it is that at 17 years of age that she loves going to Mass and all the other things that you mentioned. So you've got such a big head start with her compared to many other Catholic parents, some of whom are listening right now, wishing that they had the same situation with their kids that you have with your daughter. So here's my advice. Here's my secret, I don't know, it's not a weapon. Here's my secret trick for fixing what you want fixed. And you probably have already thought about this, but I'm going to emphasize it. Ask Our Lady to change your daughter's heart about this issue. Because if you've been trying and trying and trying, and everything you've said doesn't seem to work, well, I would take that as a cue that at least for the time being, you're not the one whom God is going to use, at least not for that particular part of it, to change her mind. And that's okay. And all of us, we have to come to the recognition, it's happened to me many times, they're not going to hear it from me for whatever reason. So I draw your attention not only to the fact that Our Lady desires your daughter to have a loving relationship with her, because after all, she leads us to Jesus. She's the one in John chapter 2 who says, do whatever he tells you. So it's to Jesus through Mary. It's not as though she's trying to draw your attention away from Jesus. She's trying to draw your attention to Jesus, as you well know, and she desires to do that with your daughter as well. And if your daughter is recalcitrant, that's okay, but remember that Our Lady will intercede for her, and you as mom asking Our Lady to intercede for her, that carries great power. Now, again, maybe you already have thought about that. Perhaps you've been praying about that. I just would like to encourage you in that regard. Now, here's another thing to think about. And I've talked about this from time to time before, but I find it very helpful, and I think you will too. In the book of Acts, there is a mysterious story about an Ethiopian eunuch. And this has to do with a figure in the early church, and his name is Philip. Now, it's not entirely clear. I think that it's most likely the Apostle Philip. This is, by the way, you read about this in Acts chapter 8. Could have been the deacon Philip, but I think it's most likely the apostle Philip. But in any case, we're told that an angel of the Lord appeared to Philip and said, rise and go toward the south to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is a desert road. Now, you notice, at least based upon what we're given here in this text in Acts chapter 8, verse 26, the angel of the Lord doesn't appear to have told Philip why he's getting up to go. He just says, get up and go. And he gets up and goes. And he goes out in the middle of nowhere. And in those days, Gaza, you know, there wasn't much to Gaza. It's a strip right along the Mediterranean coast. And so the area between Jerusalem and there is rather deserted, and it's out in the middle of nowhere where he meets an Ethiopian eunuch, a minister of the Candace, queen of Ethiopians. So he was very high up in the court, maybe the highest guy next to the queen. And he, because he was a God-fearer, he came to Jerusalem because he wanted to worship. And we're told that as he was returning, he was reading, as he was seated in his chariot, he was reading the prophet Isaiah. So he has a scroll. And the Spirit says to Philip, go up and join this chariot. So Philip ran up to him and heard him reading Isaiah, the prophet, and asked, do you understand what you are reading? And he said, how can I unless someone guides me? Then he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. Now, the passage of the scripture which he was reading was this, as a sheep led to the slaughter or a lamb before its shearer is dumb, so he opens not his mouth. In his humiliation, justice was denied him. Who can describe his generation? For his life is taken up from the earth. And the eunuch said to Philip, about whom, pray, does the prophet say this? About himself or about someone else? Then Philip opened his mouth, and beginning with this scripture, he told him the good news of Jesus. And as they went along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, "See, here is water. What is to prevent me from being baptized?" And then we're told that he was baptized. And then we're told in verse 38, he commanded the chariot to stop, and they both went down. He baptizes him, and when they came up out of the water, the Spirit of the Lord caught up Philip, and the eunuch saw him no more and went on his way rejoicing. But Philip was found at Azotus, and passing on, he preached the gospel to all the towns till he came to Caesarea. Now, again, a mysterious ending, because it ended as abruptly as it started. So as soon as he accomplished his mission, the Lord sent him away. So the reason I reference this passage is, to come back to your own situation, is because maybe the thing to do with regard to your daughter desiring to pray the rosary at some point, just start praying for a Philip. Just start asking our Lord, "Lord, please send a Philip into the life of my daughter." You know, maybe it'll be Drew Mariani. Maybe it'll be Cale Clark on the radio. Maybe it'll be Timmery. Or Josh, or one of the other figures on Relevant Radio. Maybe it'll be somebody like that. Maybe it'll be somebody you don't even know. But the key is, pray for a Philip to go into the life of your daughter, and you won't even know what the circumstances may be, but God will honor your prayer. I truly believe that. And so if this is the sticking point and you haven't been able to figure out how to get past it, I would say just let it go and let God send a Philip into the life of your daughter. And it wouldn't surprise me if down the road your daughter will say, "Mom, it was the most amazing thing. And I was talking to somebody and she said this and then that happened. Next thing you know, I'm loving praying the rosary." It could happen like that. So those are my thoughts. And I do believe that God will bless you in your zeal and your desire to see your daughter even more fulfilled by having a deep appreciation for the rosary. Thank you for that. Here's an email that comes in from Judith, who says, "If the government would be successful in removing all spoken terms relating to gender, such as him, her, he, she, etc., would they carry that into the written word as well?" She says, "I'm thinking here of translating into other languages like Spanish. Don't these clowns realize that many languages are gender-based? Spanish uses male and female terms to identify everything. El sol, la luna, etc. Will they then ban the Spanish language and others that use gender identifiers? How's that going to work?" And she says, "Gracias, amigo." Well, Judith, thank you. I mean, it's an unanswerable question. I get the point that you're making. Things like science and the rules of languages, they get in the way of certain ideologies. And one of them happens to be this inclusive language idea that if you use masculine pronouns, he, him, that you're somehow demeaning women or other people who are not even sure if they're women or not women. I would say stay the course, continue to speak the truth in love, recognizing that some people, they just don't care about the science. They just don't care about language, grammar rules. I mean, to give you an example, the ridiculous term that's been concocted, Latinx, L-A-T-I-N-X, you know, because they just can't bring themselves to say Latino or Latina. So they have to invent this stupid word. It's not even a word, but Latinx. And I guess they think that they're doing something really awesome by having this gender-neutral word. It just makes them look foolish. So if I were you, I would pay it no, never mind, as they say. I wouldn't worry about it. This is going to play itself out. It's like a fever. And eventually the fever will break. And it may take a while, but it's going to play out for a while. In the meantime, though, I would just say, speak the truth in love. Use the correct language. Help other people to see that. Do the best you can. And try not to worry about it. Lastly, before we have to take a break, here's an email that comes in from Marie. She says, "I have an uncle who studies the Colgate and Douay Rheims Bibles. Long story short, he believes in the idea of universal salvation for numerous reasons. He has a big issue with the fact that in the English translations, they were not translated well, and that many times the words are not consistently translated. For example, he says there are times the soul is translated to life, and other times life is translated to soul. The same with condemnation or damnation. She says, I hope that makes sense. When he asks a priest why that is, he never really gets an answer. Also, that there has to be a reason, not necessarily that this is done maliciously, but he feels he needs an answer. What would your response be to this? Well, simple. When you're translating one language into another, there can be a variety of different options for the word that you want to render in, say, into English. So sometimes it may be more appropriate to say soul or life, just depending upon the context. So that's a simple answer, but I think that would cover a great deal of that. But there are some very good resources at Catholic Answers about, is the Bible trustworthy? And they have articles there at Catholic.com about showing the consistency and the accuracy in the manuscripts such that we can be confident that the way in which, for most of these approved translations in any case, the way that they were translated, that they are adequate and accurate. Now that gets into an area of study that's beyond what I can share right now, but I would refer you to the Catholic Answers website for articles on that topic. All right, well, we have reached the end of this hour, and we're going to be coming back with more right after this quick timeout, so please don't go anywhere. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.